impact of tariffs. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, how concerns of a trade war with China are affecting business here in Florida. What are your questions? Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, author Nicole Saunders on her book, Disposable. Plus, we speak with the new head of the city's cultural council, Joy Young, after her first 100 days in the job. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, markets were down Tuesday over concerns of a trade war with China. Now, for months, investors and companies had been lulled into a sort of a sense of security that the world's two largest economies appeared to be getting closer to a deal to resolve their battle over trade. That calm was shattered this week when President Trump threatened to impose a new round of tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese products. Tariffs are having a real impact on locally owned businesses right here in Florida. This morning, we begin the hour with a closer look as we speak with two First Coast CEOs. David Williams is the owner and president of Power and Pumps and All Prime Pumps. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also with us, Bob Gruba. He's president and CEO of Broadway Limited Imports, a model train manufacturer. Good morning.
Morning.
And here's our question to callers. As President Trump threatens a new round of tariffs on Chinese imports, what are your thoughts and questions about that? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org or your tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open too. All right, guys, let's start by both of you explaining what your companies are and why you're dependent on imports from China. David Williams, let's start with you. What is Power and Pumps? I assume you make pumps. Yeah.
Well, thank you first, Melissa, for having us on today. And I'm in a very unglamorous business. Power and Pumps is a 42-year-old company that is a distributor of industrial products. We represent manufacturers of mainly pumps that are used in municipalities and industry, and we act as the sales and service across Florida and Georgia. And I also have a division called All Prime Pumps, for which we act essentially as a master distributor for North America. And this is the product that I import from China, and this is what is getting hit with the tariff.
And what product do you depend on that you import from China?
All Prime Pumps.
All Prime Pumps. And
yes.
So how is the tariff on this product affecting your business?
Right. Well, even though All Prime, this All Prime division is a relatively small for us from a revenue standpoint, it represents a significant part of our overall profit. And I use the income from All Prime to keep the rest of my company healthy. But as you can imagine, a 25% increase in our products puts everything in jeopardy when you're a small business. Over the past 10 months, I don't mind telling you that the tariffs have added up to just under $100,000, which is taken right off the bottom line that can't be used for raises and bonuses for all my employees, for new hires.
How many employees?
20.
Okay.
You know, right on down the line. And it puts us in a real bind. And I have a trivia question for you, Melissa. When we write a check for the tariff payments, to whom do you think we write this check?
I'm going to say the government, but that's probably wrong. So educate me.
The Department of Homeland Security.
I see.
Is who gets our
checks. Well, then yes, it goes to the government, but not the department.
Yes.
People would have thought.
No. So I mentioned this just because I think it's interesting. It emphasizes the fact that unlike our President Trump tweets that China is paying the tariffs, and he just tweeted this past Sunday that China pays the tariffs, it's simply untrue. Americans are paying the tariffs.
All right, Bob Gruba, let's talk about your business. You are the president and CEO of Broadway Limited Imports. You manufacture model trains.
We do. We've been in business for about 20 years. We design fairly high-end model trains. We sell them in hobby stores around, primarily around the U.S., but other parts of the world as well. They're manufactured in China and some in Korea. And most of our trains are not subject to the tariffs right now. But if we go to the next, whatever, the next level of $200 billion in tariffs that primarily would hit finished goods, our product would be affected by that.
And how would it impact your business?
Well, we're a fairly small margin business. We operate with about 30% profit margin, which means every dollar that we sell, we've got about 30 cents to pay salaries and insurance and things like that. A 25% tariff would take most of that profit margin. I am pretty sure that our customers would not be able to absorb that cost. Our product is already fairly expensive. We would probably have to close our operations in Florida. It would put us out of business.
You'd go out of business. Right. So if this 25% new round of tariffs goes through, you're out of business.
If we can't find a way around it. And I've been working since last March to figure a way around the tariffs.
And haven't been able to find that that path? Or are you figuring out workarounds?
It's a little bit unclear. There are a couple ways that we could potentially get around this. There's an exclusion process. I've already applied for this. It's fairly complex, and it seems to be there's a long lag time getting approved. So we've gotten no response yet from the U.S. government for our particular product. And I was able to find that if you are eventually approved, it's not retroactive. So if it took a year to get approved, even though we wouldn't necessarily be obligated to pay the tariffs, we would have already paid them and it's not retroactive.
We'll go to your calls in a moment as we look at how tariffs on Chinese imports are affecting American-owned businesses, small businesses here in Florida. It's 549-2937. And the president tweeted Sunday that he would vow to raise tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, raising the tariffs from 10 to 25%. This is coming in the middle of a visit by the premier in China, the vice premier, to come to Washington to continue trade talks. And so we'll watch that. But in the meantime, how many employees do you have at your company?
I have a total of 20. There are about 15 in Florida, 5 in North Carolina, and then I have one full-time employee that's in China.
Okay. So both you and David, you have about the same number of employees. And certainly you're not the only small business owners to be dealing with the fallout from tariffs. You know, when you look beyond your bottom line and you look at the big picture, let me ask you this, David. Overall, the economy is strong. Unemployment is low. At the same time, we are seeing signs of stress when we talk to business owners about this issue and how it's affecting their ability to keep that profit margin at a place where you can continue to employ people and give them annual raises or raises at least sometimes. So, you know, what would you say? Let me ask you this, David. For those that support the tariffs and they think it's time to get tough on China and strike a much harder line, what's your response to that? Those that are sympathetic to your struggles, but they support the idea of being tougher with China in terms of how we handle the importation of Chinese goods.
Right. Well, my understanding of the tariff fight was all about stopping China from getting intellectual property from us and allowing companies to own their own factories in China. And I'm all for that. I just think that there, you know, it kind of boils down to are we capitalists or are we protectionists? And isn't there a better way that we can negotiate to achieve these goals?
What about, too, let me ask you this, Bob Gruba, the notion that trade war, in the end, a trade wars only end in pain. History shows that. The president has seen economic advisors depart his administration because they don't agree with what he's doing when it comes to this tariff issue.
There's probably a good time and place for tariffs in certain instances. Like, for example, if we try to send circuit boards to China, there's a 25% tariff that the Chinese government imposes on ours, and that is unfair to American companies. I would not be opposed at all to a tariff that was short-term, that balanced that out and was used as an incentive to get the Chinese to drop their tariffs. That appears to be a good, in my opinion, use for a tariff. But the tariffs that we're talking about now are kind of a blunt instrument that is going to not just harm Chinese companies, it's going to harm American companies, it's going to make my employees have to go out and find another job. And my employees, they're good employees. They average about $50,000 a year plus 401k and retirement and all that. It's hard to find for in this area. It's hard to find 20 good jobs like that.
Okay. And at the same time as we talk about this, here's a look at the numbers when we expand it out to the entire country. If tariffs on Chinese imports are hiked to 25%, they're currently at 10%, that would affect thousands of products and parts, everything from furniture to clothes, electronics, hardware. We're talking everything from perfume to bed sheets and bicycles, new vehicle prices. Really, almost all aspects of our consumer economy would be affected by this. Here's a quote from David French. He's Senior VP of Government Relations for the National Retail Federation. He says a sudden tariff increase with less than a week's notice would severely disrupt U.S. businesses, especially small companies like your companies, guys. He says American consumers will face higher prices and U.S. jobs will be lost. So given that bleak picture, David, how hopeful are you that a deal can be struck that would avoid this onerous hike in the duty on Chinese imports?
How hopeful am I?
Not very?
No, I'm totally hopeful that they can do this. I don't know if they're going about it quite the right way, but what do I know?
What do you mean by that?
I just think that the demonstrative tweets that go out tend to submarine the whole process. And I wish maybe these things were going on behind closed doors rather than out in the open like this.
Okay, and you're referring to the president's tweets about tariffs and China. Okay, and let's go to your calls now as we speak with business owners David Williams and Bob Gruba, both who employ about 20 people apiece at their locally owned businesses here on the First Coast. As they talk about the impact of tariffs on their bottom line, we want your calls. 549-2937. What are your thoughts and questions? Mark is in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You kind of touched on this earlier, but my comment has to do with what other options are available. We didn't get into this situation that we're in overnight, and I think a lot of people get upset at Trump because he kind of comes into the approach with ripping the Band-Aid off very quickly. And I certainly understand and appreciate the financial impact on, you know, your guests' bottom line with their company and the you know, how it can affect employees and all that. But the big problem that I believe they're trying to correct is that issue that you talked about a few minutes ago with intellectual property rights and the things that China, for lack of a better word, is stealing from American companies. So is there, I don't know if your guests have been involved in any kind of trade discussions or offered up opportunities on how else to correct this problem. But in the absence of any other type of solution, what would they suggest as a way to correct that issue with China so that it doesn't hurt them, you know, and their business?
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, thanks for that question. David Williams, owner of Power and Pumps. What do you think?
I'd like to make one comment about that. The product that we import was patented 60 years ago. So it's been decades past the patent protection and intellectual property protection. It's old but very valid technology. We copied this pump, just like Walgreens and CVS copy NyQuil and hundreds of other products on their shelves. So it's common practice. It's simply a way for us to offer our users a lower cost alternative for out of patent products. And I agree with the caller that we do need to protect our intellectual property. We need to figure out a better way of dealing with China on that.
Bob Gruba.
So I personally hold about 15 U.S. patents covering our product. When we manufacture our product in China, we still own the intellectual property rights. We take a number of steps to prevent them from being pirated. For example, the software in our product is fairly complex. We write that here. We send it to our manufacturer in a format that it can't be read. It could be copied and duplicated, but it could, which means they could make one product over and over again. But our product varies constantly, and so it would be very difficult for a manufacturer to copy that product, and they certainly couldn't copy our product and ship it back to the U.S. Because the U.S. we have very strong patent trademark protection, and if our industry is fairly small, if someone sold more than one or two of our models, we would know, and we could shut them down rapidly.
And yeah, and as the caller asked, what are some solutions? There have been a number of economists who have put forth, you know, big picture solutions involving the World Trade Organization, negotiations with China that are more narrowly tailored, reining in Chinese practices that violate intellectual property rights. The question becomes, how do you conduct those negotiations when you're dealing with, frankly, an authoritarian regime that has taken a very extra legal approach, I guess is fair to say, with how to conduct this. As all of this plays out, and by the way, we're rebooting our phone system quickly, everyone listening out there, so stay on hold and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. As all of this plays out, small businesses are being harmed and bigger companies are being harmed, particularly steel companies. We've heard a lot about that. And, you know, larger corporations that employ more American workers, are auto manufacturers and others, David, they're also being harmed.
Absolutely. We represent one particularly large technology company that everyone has heard of. You'd find their products in Best Buy, and they also make industrial products. So when the tariffs were announced, they were able to move an entire production facility from China to their factory-owned plant in India. So the complete process is taking about a year, and in the meantime, to offset the tariffs, they pass along these large price increases to us that we pass along to our customers, who then pass along to their customers, and so on. And so this is what is slowly but surely happening in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that a small company is stuck. The larger companies can move around and make things happen.
Here are lots of emails as we talk with local CEOs about increased tariffs on Chinese imports. Lowell emails the show. The local company UST has been hit hard. 80 people and millions in port traffic are leaving Jacksonville in a consolidation move. They've been hit by tariff increases. While major buyers are also, like Walmart, not accepting price increases, imagine costs going up 25% and no way to recoup that. Mike emails the show. The answer is simple. Don't buy things in China, made in China, and you don't pay the tariffs. Well, now, you both are particularly you, Bob, you're making an American-made product, so of course you support that. It's easier said than done to just say, I'm not going to buy anything made in China.
So prior to starting my own company, I was the director of engineering for Lionel Trains. That's an old manufacturer of model trains. The Lionel Trains customer very much wanted a made in America product. At that time, this was in the 1990s, that company spent millions of dollars trying to get the injection molds made to manufacture its product, continue manufacturing its product in the U.S. We were unable to get the injection molds made. We spent, like I said, millions of dollars. And the issue boils down to the U.S. does not have the trade schools to teach the tool makers like some of these other countries have. At the time, our competitors were making injection molds in Korea, and the Koreans were, at that time, probably the best in the world at making injection molds. Mm-hmm. The Koreans transferred a lot of that technology to China because they couldn't get enough workers in Korea. And now The Chinese companies are having a difficult time getting enough workers with their growth. And so a lot of this technology is now moving to Vietnam. And I started about last April to get a factory going in Vietnam. And I would love to have brought that to the United States, but I don't know how to get the tool makers to make to actually be able to physically build the injection molds that we need to make our product. We do not have that expertise. My company is too small to get a country like the United States to invest in trade schools. So a company like mine, we just have to go where we can get the product. We go where we can buy it.
So the employees don't exist in this country that are trained to do that kind of work.
We do not have the trade schools to teach the employees to do that.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? And that brings up a whole new kettle of fish, how we train and educate our workforce. But in the meantime, we do have our phones working again. Let's go to some more calls. 549-2937. Lisa is in Riverside. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I wanted to call and make a comment about Frontline's show last night on the tariff. But first, I wanted to respond to Mark from St. Augustine, who called in asking what else could possibly be done. I've heard Condoleezza Rice speak about the tariffs, and she said there are many tools in the toolbox for working on this issue with China, and the tariffs are least effective. So he might want to look into her remarks and some other trade experts. Frontline, in case anybody missed it last night, had a show on the tariffs, and they interviewed both Gary Cohn and Steve Bannon, who represented two very different views that the administration looked into, and they ended up taking Steve Bannon's views. That is something the public really, really needs to look into. Watch the show if you haven't had a chance to, because it's far more than just intellectual property rights and some trade practices, which pretty much everybody agrees needs to be fixed. The Steve Bannon view is that there will be one winner and one loser in a U.S.-China battle. And that's pretty scary, considering they're the two world's largest economies. And he even talked about regime change in China. And that's that was shocking to me. I had no idea their views were that dark on China. And so I really recommend everybody go back and, if you missed that show, to find it online and watch it, because it's really important information. And
yeah.
Thanks. I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate that. And in that program, yes, you got a sense of the advisors that were around the president, those that looked at the economy as an interlinked global concern and wanted to work within that, or those that fall more on the line of this is a zero-sum game. We must win. The other player must lose. And yes, you're right in that Condoleezza Rice and others have called tariffs probably in the end not an effective way to deal with this issue. Here's a tweet from a listener. A caller asked about alternatives. Recall the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was a multilateral approach to increase international property protections through the Pacific and Asia. This was designed as a great trade wall, but both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump rejected it. All right, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. David, you're shaking your head. You don't want to talk about that. Bob, what about you?
Don't know a thing about it.
Yeah.
Because you've been focused, I mean, to be fair, you've been focused, both of you, on running your business.
Well,
right?
Government almost every day gets in the way of a company like ours. We get letters from the IRS to deal with something from years ago. We, during the Obama administration, we absorbed a fairly substantial, for us, increase to our medical costs that we provide for our employees. Those went up by about 30%. We're used to government interference in our business. It happens almost daily. This, for my company, is the first existential threat to our company. And
how worried are you? You're going to go under, that you will be out of business.
I think I can find a way around it. Like I said, we started last April building a factory in Vietnam that is just starting to operate. It would be really difficult for us to transfer all of our production to that in a week's notice. We just flat couldn't do it. We make a fairly complex product. I think we can survive, but it's only because I've been working on it for over a year now. And as I talk to other businesses, a lot of them don't seem to understand, or they don't accept that this could be a reality, that we would actually be faced with this. And also, there are companies that can absorb the increase. Like if you just import a circuit board that you put in your product, and it's a $20 circuit board, a 25% tariff, it adds $5. If we were adding $5 to our product, we wouldn't care. We would pass that on to our customers. But we import the entire product. So our product is already selling, we sell a single locomotive for between $500 and $800. I think if we had to increase that by 25%, it would push our production quantities below the minimal accepted order size for our factories, and they wouldn't build for us anymore. We would be gone if we can't find a way around this.
Mm. Daryl is in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Hold on. Let me get you off speakerphone.
Yeah, thanks for holding so patiently, Daryl. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, just an observation. If you knew the stock market was going to drop 2% in 2 days from Donald Trump's tweets, you could make hundreds of millions of dollars. Who knew that he was going to do this? I'm always follow the money. Somebody is making hundreds of millions of dollars from Donald Trump's tweets. Who? I don't know if anybody is going to look into this. And just as a observation, he did have a two-hour conversation on Saturday, the day before he sent out these tweets, with his buddy Vladimir Putin, somebody who could, you know, short the stock market for a few hundred million dollars.
Yeah, Daryl, I see where you're going with that. And you're right, there is no proof of that. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts, though, because certainly the president's Twitter feed does have the power to move markets. And we're seeing that right now. Okay, let's wrap this up, guys. David Williams, tell me about your next steps as you watch this play out for your company.
Well, I just have to continue to cut costs in any way I can to survive, basically. I hope my banker isn't listening. And, but we've put a lot of time and effort, 15 years, into getting where we are today. And I believe we're in a global economy, and we just need to figure out a way to work, everyone to work together.
Bob Gruba.
Well, as I've talked about, we are attempting to get an exemption from the tariffs. We are in the process of moving a portion of our production to Vietnam, and I will continue along that path. And if the tariffs do in fact hit my product, we'll obviously accelerate that to the best of our ability.
Thank you both gentlemen for joining us. David Williams, owner and president, Power and Pumps and All Prime Pumps. Bob Gruba, president and CEO of Broadway Limited Imports. Thanks, guys. Good luck.
Thanks for having us.
Much more still ahead. Later, we speak with the new head of the Cultural Council of Greater Jax. But up next, author Nicole Saunders. We'll be right back.
Join WJCT and PNC Grow Up Great to celebrate Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Meet Daniel Tiger, Katarina Kitty Cat, and their friends. Tour TIAA Bank Field, meet community helpers, face painters, enjoy local food trucks, arts and crafts, and so much more. Reserve your spot today for this free, family-friendly community event by visiting wjct.org. Start something good in your neighborhood.
WJCT has a new podcast called What It's Like.
Do you think people ever saw you differently because you have a disability?
Yeah.
I'm the host, Lindsay Kilbride, and I took some of the most compelling conversations collected in Jacksonville by StoryCorps. Then I got a deeper look.
What would you want those people to know about you?
We're just a human being.
Subscribe now to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
From the roots of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Tufaz, 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
Welcome back. She's a local attorney balancing life in the legal field with a budding career as an author. In her book, Disposable, Nicole Saunders looks at the lengths parents will go to in order to create the perfect family. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for being with us. So you're a lawyer and an author, and in this novel, Disposable, you get into incredibly deep issues that families go through when it comes to adoption, surrogacy, and more. Tell us about the plot of Disposable.
Disposable is about a young girl. She's struggling in college, and she decides to be the surrogate for a wealthy couple. Things are going well until a medical test shows that the child is going to have a disability. And from there, the question becomes what to do and how to go forward.
And what issues does that raise in the story?
A lot of moral issues regarding the value of life. What is a disposable person versus a person who has value? How do we value people in life? And how do we view women in society as well?
What prompted this storyline for you? How did you come up with the idea?
Well, actually, it was based on a conversation I had with my sister. One day we were just sitting down talking about issues, and I'm very passionate about policy, and I'm very passionate about issues that involve women and people with disabilities, such as myself. And so we had a conversation, and she's like, well, wouldn't it be interesting if somebody wrote a book about surrogacy? And I said, oh, it would be. And from there, the idea came to me. I just started writing.
And surrogacy, I mean, I tend to think of surrogacy as something only wealthy women can do, or celebrities, by and large, although that's probably not altogether true. But you tend to think of it as something privileged couples do that can afford to pay someone to carry the child.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's also a theme in the book, because there is sort of that disconnect between the protagonist and the couple, that she is in a financially dependent position and they are in a wealthier position, and kind of what that plays into in terms of power play.
And so do you make a value judgment on whether couples decide to not continue with a pregnancy when they know that the baby has a severe abnormality or birth defect, or do you let the reader decide how this should be handled?
I think definitely, I mean, I have my personal views on it, but I definitely try to leave it open for the reader to make the determination, because there's no bad character necessarily. Well, it's kind of a bad character, but not really a bad character in the book. It's really a lot of people with conflicting views on a similar situation. And so, you know, at the end of it, I try not to give away too much about my personal view on it, but it is up to the reader.
You know, it's also interesting, too, because your character of Anna Lynn is a college student in debt, like so many young people, and she sees a way out of it by acting as a surrogate.
Yes.
That's kind of fascinating, too.
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to kind of play on that as well, the fact that there are certainly people in the country, students, people who are not, you know, not much younger than myself, who are in debt and have to make some really difficult choices as to how to fund education and things like that, and the position it can put you in.
And how did you get started on the path of first you started as an attorney and then as an author. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and your education and your trajectory.
So it's interesting. I actually started writing when I was 10 years old. And I actually sat down at a computer and just started writing. And I've always loved telling stories. My love for writing came way before my interest in law. And so it's just one of those things where as I kind of got older and I learned more about legal writing and different types of writing styles, I realized they blended well together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely I have to say writing is my first love.
And, you know, as someone, you have a disability, you are in a wheelchair, so you can write about this in a way that someone who does not have a disability, they just don't have the same level of understanding.
Right. And that's part of what inspired me to write it.
Yeah. So what's that? Tell me a little bit more about that.
So, I mean, basically, kind of what you were saying, I find that a lot of times in popular media, people with disabilities are kind of viewed as a source of inspiration or as almost like non-multidimensional people. And we are multidimensional.
Right.
And so I wanted to express that in the book.
Okay. And the book has been out for a little while now. It's becoming a popular book club selection.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think just the themes in the book, they're ripe for discussion. People have passionate views about it. And when they read it, they either they react typically very strongly to the characters and the plot line. So I think that it makes it exciting for book clubs.
Now, do you still practice law or are you a full-time author now?
I'm an attorney. I'm still practicing law.
Still practicing.
I'm a litigator here in Jacksonville.
Wow. So do you plan another novel or writing a book is a huge undertaking. So what's next for you?
Yes. I definitely am still writing. I try to keep that up. We did just release a second edition of Disposable that, you know, talks about the discussion questions and things like that. But I also am certainly working on other works to keep publishing.
Okay. Well, keep us posted.
All right.
Can't wait to hear about the next one.
Oh, thank you.
Nicole Saunders is an attorney and author based here on the First Coast. Her novel, Disposable, just saw the release of its second edition. Nicole, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Well, she's the new head of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Joy Young arrives from a previous role leading the South Carolina Arts Commission, and she's got big plans to grow arts and culture here on the First Coast. Joy recently marked her first 100 days in the job, and she joins us now. Hey, good morning.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm great, and welcome to town.
Thank you so much.
And you are in charge of an institution that is so important for Jacksonville, and you come to town with such glowing recommendations. So we're thrilled to have you here on the First Coast. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You come from, you were in a job for some time in South Carolina, right?
That's right. So I was with the South Carolina Arts Commission for 14 years, but my own journey has been one in the arts. I am that young student who didn't find success in math and science. It was music that gave me an opportunity to see success.
What did you play? What instrument?
So I'm a vocalist.
Oh, you're a singer.
Yes, I am a singer. And the chorus room was my sanctuary, and it was chorus teachers who really helped me see there was a place for me in the world, and that was in arts and culture.
Did you study that in college as well?
I most certainly did. So I attended Columbia College for an undergraduate in music. I studied at Manhattan School of Music in New York City. Worked with the renowned, but no longer here with us, Betty Allen at Harlem School of the Arts. And finally finished my master's degree at City College of New York, Hunter College.
So working with some of the top talents and thought leaders in the field, and That is so exciting to hear about because it shows how a career in the arts, not only is it rewarding, you're making a contribution to society. And that's really what the Cultural Council is all about, just demonstrating the value of a vibrant arts and culture community to this city, both in terms of just the aesthetics and the economy as
Without a doubt. You know, when we talk about the value of arts and culture, we should always start with what the intrinsic value is, how arts and culture illuminates our inner lives, how it enriches our emotional world. We just had a wonderful author, Nicole, with her book, who is able to help us see a different way through her own writing. Indeed, you know, we do cherish that intrinsic value. But we also realize that there are other kinds of benefits in creating a vibrant arts community. We know that it helps residents engage in conversation, create community. And of course, there's the economic impact. So we have both an instrumental value and an intrinsic value.
Yeah, for every, I forget the statistic, but it's something like for every dollar we spend in Jacksonville on arts and culture, the overall economy gets a huge return. Yeah. $10 are put into the economy. So it's worth the money.
Without a doubt. You know, the most recent economic impact data we have from 2017 shows that in Florida alone, we have a $4.68 billion economic impact. We have jobs. Here in Jacksonville, that translates to over $82 million in economic impact. It gives us over 200 jobs, full-time jobs, as well as part-time jobs. And we're not even talking about the entire nonprofit arts sector. We're just talking about 27 arts organizations. And the Cultural Council really does want to expand its work in serving all nonprofit arts organizations.
And I can't wait to hear more about that, about your plans for creating a bigger footprint for arts and culture here on the First Coast, as we speak with Joy Young, the new leader of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. What is on tap? We're going to find out in just a little bit as we continue this conversation. And we talk about everything from art in public places to Leap for Arts. What's that all about? We have much more still to come. Keep listening as we talk art and culture here on the show with Joy Young of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Much more in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Tufas. 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
Towns up and down the Mississippi River are flooding. For many, this is just the latest in a string of back-to-back so-called one-in-100-year floods.
Well, I think the use of this one-in-100-year and one-in-500-year is confusing to people.
I'm Ari Shapiro, looking for better ways to communicate flood risk this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Democrats upped the pressure on Attorney General William Barr, who refused to show them the full Mueller report. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin refuses a congressional request for President Trump's tax returns. And Trump says he won't respond to any congressional subpoenas. Is this a constitutional crisis? We'll ask our political strategists next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, how the junk science of eugenics and anti-immigration sentiment merged in a 1924 restrictive law that kept out Jews, Italians, and Eastern Europeans. A Nazi handbook cited this law as a model for Germany. We'll talk with Daniel Okrent, whose book describes how the scientific racism movement shaped American immigration law. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Artificial intelligence does a lot for us. Sometimes it even thinks on our behalf. But can AI be creative? Today's computers can learn, evolve, and replicate human expression. New technology could redefine what it means to create and what it means to be human. Putting the art in artificial intelligence. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. As we continue our conversation now with Joy Young, the new head of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, we're looking at the future of the organization. So you were chosen over a crowded field of candidates, and you are winning nothing but raves for your experience and your vision. What do you plan to do to, you know, create more buzz even now than there already is around arts and culture in our community?
Yeah, well, you know, I have my personal vision, but it's also important to definitely reach out to the communities we serve, the arts organizations and individual artists, to come together and to coalesce around an idea of what's important to them. But my own vision is for arts and culture and creativity in Jacksonville to be valued, to be funded and recognized for both its social and its economic impact in our lives, in our communities, in our schools. You know, I want to see Jacksonville acknowledged nationally as the leading city for supporting arts and culture, for embracing creativity, and even cultural entrepreneurship. You know, I want to be able to help demonstrate that access to funding and resources to support this important sector results in a positive economic impact. We want to grow Jacksonville, and arts and culture are central to that for increasing and supporting quality of life here in this city.
Now, one of the ways you do that is through the Cultural Council's Art in Public Places program. What are the plans for art in public places?
Yes, well, if I'm not mistaken, last week you had our public art director on the show, yeah. Glenn Wise. And we are really wanting to make sure that the art that is happening around town is, again, reflective of the communities where art begins to be placed. There's a great project that is in the works on the Water Street Garage using lighting. We're working in some of the parks, Cuba Hunter Park and the Winton Drive and Legends Community Center area. So keep on the lookout for that public artwork. And we are certainly interested in developing public-private partnerships to place public art around the city of Jacksonville.
Okay. And let's explain why public art does so much to make a city more vibrant. There are so many examples we could point to, not just in downtown, but as you said, you're trying to expand it out from the urban core. When a public space has art, it changes it. It changes the whole energy of the space and the people interacting with the space, right?
Exactly. And you take a city like New York City that enjoyed the fences installation in the park.
In Central Park,
that's
yeah.
correct. Thank you. You realize that not only did people come to see this particular installation, but they talked about the installation and they engaged in the natural setting. But it also brought over $30 million in economic impact to the city. Public art helps give character to a space. Public art tells a story of a space. And let's face it, public art just makes a place animated and an opportunity for community to come together to engage. And Jacksonville has public art that is created by artists who have work in other cities. And it creates then a synergy to be able to say, you know, if New York City can have a piece of art by a particular artist, So can Jacksonville, and we are doing that.
In the short amount of time we have left, you have a new initiative as well, Leap for Arts. What is Leap for Arts?
Indeed. So with my arrival and understanding that the Cultural Council wants to make a leap, we want to be leaders, we want to engage, we want to activate, and we want to partner. So not only is Leap that which we will do, it is also an annual fundraiser and an arts awareness, if you will, event rather. We will begin on September 4th with our State of the Arts, and that's a regional conference for arts and business leaders. We'll focus on creativity and using creativity for problem framing, for problem solving.
There's a lot happening, so we're excited to have you here on the show after your first weeks on the job, and come back and see us.
Indeed, and we would love for all of you to leap with us. Hashtag Leap for Arts.
Leap for Arts is the hashtag as Joy Young, the new head of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, takes over this valuable cultural institution. Joy, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
All right, that is our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Quorum is our director. If you have questions, comments, feedback, we always want to hear it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And on tomorrow's show, the push to implement a half-cent sales tax to shore up aging school buildings across Duval County. That's tomorrow. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. That's after the news. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.